This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four.
Episode 17, 1971, Part 3.
I had no intention of trying to dominate anything. I always felt like I'm a follower. People used to say he's a creator. I said, no create. I didn't create Spider-Man. I didn't create any of this. Ditko, Stan, they created Spider-Man. What I'm doing is I'm illustrating it. I'm an illustrator and I'm a storyteller, but I didn't create anything. I always tell them, never call me a creator.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast, your year-by-year journey through the publishing history of the Marvel Universe from its inception in 1961, and we have made it all the way up to our final installment on 1971. We have covered over a decade of Marvel Comics at this point, as of this most recent episode you're about to hear, and what a decade it has been. I, of course, am one of the Sarcastic Four, one of your co-hosts, Nick Duke. Alongside me, as always, are the other members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with the Bachelor himself, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you this fine solo evening?
Yes, in a surprise announcement, my wife and I have separated for a week, so she will be back later. But it's
one
been
of them
fun.
Hall pass trial separations, right?
Yeah, it's really not like that, but it's more a matter of her having an opportunity to take an extra week vacation in an island paradise. Who am I to say no? I go to WrestleMania by myself, so. But yeah, otherwise, nothing else is doing. I'm just nothing but a honky in my long johns.
Honky. And we will discuss the word honky at great length in this podcast. Over in Virginia, another honky, Mr. Tim Cable. Tim, how are you tonight?
Ah, Nick, I prostrate myself and open my blasphemous butthole, not unlike Brian Knobs in a truck stop restroom, to you and to the Unholy Four.
That is an alleged occurrence. We will not speak of it as documented fact. And rounding out the panel, yet another honky. Surprise, surprise. A comics podcast with four honkies. Who'd have thunk it? Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
Much like the awful, awful trailer for Cats that just came out, I am already in need of a reboot.
Man, isn't the theater going to be a weird place to be that day between all the furries and the Star Wars nerds coming together for one big conflagration?
I'm just wondering who over at whatever studio it is that produced this Cats movie was thinking whenever they were looking at the slate of movies coming out for the rest of the year and picking out their release date, and they saw that one and they said, "Hey, what's coming out that day? Oh, Star Wars? We got this." Yeah, we're
going to counter programming something, right? Something, I don't know. You know, there's a market for everything, and the furry market has been drastically underserved in recent years. And I guess this is going to be their big breakout hit. This is going to be their Black Panther or Wonder Woman. This is their moment when they step to the forefront of pop culture and seize their moment in the sun.
I think it's going to be their Terminator Genesis.
Well, we shall see.
Those two worlds converged once before in a movie called Return of the Jedi. Thank you, Tim. Yeah. Tim knows me better than I know myself.
Well, I was going to say, who are we to count out the possibility of Ewoks appearing again in this last Star Wars trilogy installment?
Oh, I'm for it. I think that's a wonderful idea. Make it so, J.J.
Sure.
Yep.
More porgs, too. Yes, more porgs. As long as it involves Chewbacca attempting to eat them, that would be awesome. We're not here to talk about Star Wars, although there are Star Wars comics on the forefront at some point in the 70s coming up in Marvel, no less. But I doubt we will cover those. As they are not.
I don't know what we do with those.
Yeah, I think we just leave those out. I think we made a determination that the purpose of this project at this time is to track the formation of the Marvel Universe. And then if, you know, 20 years from now when we're still doing this podcast and we wrap up the, you know, catch up to current day and we want to go back and look at some other stuff, we can certainly exercise that right if we so choose. But the likelihood of one or all of us being dead from massive coronaries due to poor health, alcoholism, and, you know, just general fat shit laziness is far higher than us actually reaching the end of this podcast. But I digress. In any event, we are here to bring you the final part in our discussion of 1971. Tonight we'll be covering Fantastic Four 113 through 116, Marvel Feature 1 to 2, The Amazing Spider-Man 100 through 102, Thor 191 through 194, and Captain America 143. So let's kick off our discussion with the first family of Marvel and track. We have tracked the entire calendar year of Fantastic Four, I believe, to this point, minus maybe an issue. I'm trying to remember the exact details, but here we are wrapping it up with a four-part story involving the Overmind, a eternal or eternal, if you're nasty, villain from the far-off cosmos who's been prophesied to destroy the universe, make it crush the universe, and make it kneel before him. We are also getting the ongoing drama of Ben Grimm, who has been given the ability to turn back into his normal self, but with it has come drastic personality changes that have rendered him even more of an asshole than he can be at times anyway, rendering him back to some of his early personality that we discussed in those first couple years of Fantastic Four. But I got to say, guys, for all the – there are definitely some low points in this four-part story. We can talk about those if you'd like, namely being I didn't really like the extended Overmind flashback origin deal. It just didn't hook me or whatever. The Deus Ex Machina that is utilized to wrap up the story near the end is also a bit frustrating. But other than that, I mean, for the most part, this kind of flowed pretty well for me. I think I wound up liking this a lot more than I've liked the other Fantastic Four stuff we've read in 1971 in a year where we've read more Fantastic Four than ever before. So overall, I'm going to give this a thumbs up. Russell, what about you? I know you had some thoughts on it in the group thread earlier.
I'd say overall I enjoyed this one, but it's not my favorite Fantastic Four story that we've ever read by any stretch. I can agree with the Overmind story being the Overmind origin story being just a little drawn out, but I do appreciate that it gave us a big chunk of background on the Eternals. As everybody who was paying attention to San Diego Comic-Con recently knows, the Eternals are about to be a big deal in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So this is kind of a cool thing to give us a peek at their beginnings, or at least like how they are going to come into play a little bit later. As far as like Ben Grimm's stuff is concerned, they seem to kind of wrap that up as neatly as possible. I mean, one gets shot to the head from the Hulk and he seems okay again. So not too bad on that end. The part of this that wasn't working for me though was we get an extra long issue in this, as there are like a few issues as we're going to go along that are like double sized. And one of these issues featured Reed Richards kind of defeated, basically the entire Fantastic Four defeated, and Sue is having to go off and find someone to help the Fantastic Four get the upper hand on the Overmind. And it takes so freaking long to get there. It is just this long, drawn-out slog of her, like, pining over how are they going to get through this. And I was like, wow, we could really just get to the point anytime now. That'd be great. And ultimately, she winds up, of course, going to Dr. Doom, who I contest is superior to Reed Richards in every way. And we don't get nearly enough Doom in that issue, but he shows up and he does a really great job, has some of the best lines in the entire story. But I didn't like the Deus Ex Machina of the Watcher showing up and suddenly, oh, he's going to put everything right again, because apparently the Overmind really is too much for everyone to handle. Not the best overall effort, but A+ for finally having Reed Richards drop the pretense, because I don't buy for a second that he was completely under the control of the Overmind's influence when he goes on the most misogynistic tirade he's gone on yet. And I think he was just airing out how he really feels about everything. He thinks everyone around him is stupid, especially his wife. So there you have it. Reed Richards is an asshole. It's on display for the entire world. And then he becomes a hindrance and then an absolutely useless albatross around the neck of the rest of the FF and the later part of this story. So there you have it. This is not too bad. It's showing Reed Richards for what he is, so I'm good with it.
Yeah, certainly a unique reading of the Reed Richards situation, and one that is probably more intended to troll our good friend Mike than anything else. But I will say, I kind of enjoyed reading this story more than I have in virtually any other. Like, he was kind of he was there to save Ben, was the one guy who was not just willing to accept Ben as dead there, and kind of heroically brought him back. And then getting to be a full dick was kind of nice, even though I am going with the controlled by the overmind view of things. But you mentioned double-sized issues. I guess before we get too deep into the discussion here at the last part of 1971, we should cover that a bit. Tim, I think you had a little background on that for us.
Yeah, we've got some almost, not quite, but just about double-sized issues in this run of comics. It's going to be all of the, I believe, November cover-dated issues. Rather than carrying 20 story pages, they have 35, a whopping 35 story pages. And this higher page count, that was, from what I have gathered, part of a scheme hatched by publisher Martin Goodman to outmaneuver DC in terms of market share. So basically, long story short, Marvel and DC always kind of had a gentleman's agreement, let's say, that we're going to have our comics, our entire line, priced at the same retail price, and any cost increases, we are going to coordinate and plan those so that they happen at exactly the same time. So basically, they're going to try to avoid undercutting one another with, you know, pricing wars that might benefit the consumer but not too good for the publishers. And here in 1971, they had decided that they were going to increase prices from 15 cents to 25 cents. But at the same time, they're upping the standard page count, right? So again, going from 20 to 35 pages of story. So you get a pretty steep price hike. You know, that's a 10 cents increase, nothing to us today. But if you look at it in terms of, you know, this is increasing your monthly comics budget by about 70%, although at the same time, you're getting 75% more content. Not a bad value to you, the consumer, you know, considering you don't typically get additional content alongside these fairly standard price increases. The problem, of course, is that Marvel did not have any intentions of sticking with this new model. That's why we see, just for 1 month, the additional page count, and it drops right back to 20 pages the very next month. So basically, that was to force DC's hand to remain a step above DC, so that DC is now in the position of, oh crap, we have to adjust our prices because Marvel's trying to screw us, and DC was not as quick to move on their feet on these types of things without pretty careful planning. So in a roundabout way, Marvel just made a very basic price increase from 15 cents to 20 cents, no additional pages, but they did it in such a roundabout way by, for 1 month, giving you additional story pages for five extra cents. So very convoluted here, but the end result was that for the very first time in history, Marvel did overtake DC as the market leader, and they're going to remain in this position for a little while. So kind of a historical curio at this point, but I think it is worth noting since it is significant for that aspect.
Absolutely. And your thoughts on this Fantastic Four four-part story we read? Are you high on it?
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think I'm a little bit higher on it than Russell. I feel like this was an attempt to do the first real cosmic level, cosmic stakes type of epic, following from the original Galactus trilogy. Of course, now we don't have Jack Kirby, So your mileage may vary here. John Buscema turns in pretty good work here as artist. We probably haven't talked about him enough in terms of just his contributions to this series. Stan has come along, I think, as a writer enough that he can do a lot of the heavy lifting that I think he was more dependent on Jack Kirby for doing for most of this run. So we end up with this villain, the Overmind, who doesn't have a lot in terms of a personality, right? But has a pretty clear motivation. So I thought that the origin was probably the weakest part of what issue was that? 115, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was the third issue, right?
Yeah, third issue of this four-parter. However, that issue does have the advantage of being scripted by Archie Goodwin. So for the first time, we've got someone other than Stan Lee scripting Fantastic Four. Kind of a big deal, and I thought Goodwin turned in pretty good work. That script is punchy. It's got some kind of fun, topical pop culture references. Has some pretty glorious purple prose, especially in that Overmind origin sequence. So all in all, I don't know that I'd call it an improvement over Stan, but they're really not missing a beat here and handing the reins off. So surprisingly enjoyable story for me. I wasn't sure what to expect from this going into it, but I did enjoy it for what it was.
Absolutely. Todd, your thoughts?
Hey now, Fantastic Four. This was a wonderful story, I thought. There were complaints I have. They wrapped up the Ben thing very quickly, very neatly. He was seemingly killed by the Hulk. Reed has to take him back to the lab, and he senses a heartbeat. But they bring him to, and Ben's good as new after Ben crushes the machine that could have maintained his changing form, I believe. Johnny hates that. Johnny's like emo Johnny all the way through, missing Crystal. He goes along with the plan here to take on the Overmind, but after that, he's Gonzo again. But I think the coup de grace was bringing in Dr. Doom. They've been holding off on returning Dr. Doom to the FF book for a long time. We saw him briefly in issue 100, and then we hadn't seen him in a long time. And it's pretty fun to see him with the Fantastic Four for the greater good of humanity here, or at least for his own self-interests. I do wonder, something that kind of cracked me up was, why is Doom at the Latverian embassy and not in his castle? You know, that was kind of convenient for me again.
Like, I believe he was murdering a journalist, I believe is the idea.
Ah.
Oh, God.
Very good.
Well...
There, I will talk about Archie Goodwin. He doesn't miss a beat, really does not. If you didn't know it was Archie, you would say that, okay, this is consistent with the last couple issues. It's very fleshing out of the story. Buscema, we see more of his true style in another book we'll talk about later, in what I like to call the Marvel dynamic action that he does. This still feels like he's aping Kirby a little bit, especially in like the design of the Overmind and a lot of the tech, but it's a cosmic story. What do you want to do? But the Watcher shows up in almost every issue, and he looks a little different depending on what they're doing with his costuming. You know, it looks like a giant baby in a cape. It's late in later years where John Byrne would be drawing the Watcher. You'd have this big head on a little body. But here he has a tiny head on a big body. He looks like kind of like the Kingpin trying to do cosplay. It's interesting, and he has different colors they show out throughout here. Agatha Harkness continues to contribute things. She kind of teams up with the Watcher and brings you the origin of the Overmind. But we get more background on the Eternals and who were their. Counterparts here, the mega humans, the gigantus.
Oh, the
Gigantus, yes.
Gigantons.
The world that is the size of a galaxy, basically.
So the Eternals create the Overmind, who is kind of like a billion of their brains combined into one to pass on their legacy after they've died. And then Gigantus has their own champion entitled the Stranger, who I'm trying to think of a celebrity he most resembles. I'm going to say Sam Waterston, or let's see, I'm trying to think somebody else he could be. Just that look, you know, the gruff.
Yeah.
It doesn't indicate a cosmic stranger to me in red and green. But I digress. He comes up, he saves the day, and we move on. You know, Fantastic Four deemed worthy just because they survived. They bring back Reed. Everything goes back to the status quo, and, you know, it was pretty good. We've read certainly worse FF than this. And
in this year alone.
Yes, recently. But it did kind of take a little while. I think that third chapter of The Origin was a little bit of a slog, but I would say that there were other books that kind of were harder to get through for me throughout the week. Is this the best story I read this year? No, but... is it good comics? Absolutely.
Yeah. That's kind of where I fall on it as well. Anything else that we want to cover from 113 to 116 before we move on?
I will say that the Deus Ex Machina of the Stranger
show.
Oh,
God. Yeah, we didn't talk about that at all, really, did we?
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. Easily, to me, the worst part of the story. Like, just out of nowhere, it feels so convenient and contrived. And I think probably part of the problem is, you know, it mentioned, had an editor's note in the story that, as you've probably seen in other Marvel mags, I don't think we've read any other Stranger appearances.
We haven't, yeah. I was going to say, in fairness, he is a pre-existing character. He first appeared, I believe, of all places, in X-Men, oddly enough, where he turned Magneto and Toad into, like, science experiments, which was somewhat unique. But, no, we have not read any of his prior appearances, and he just sort of pops in here. I guess I appreciate sort of bookending this resolution with a reveal that, oh, the Eternals had their grand champion who's the composite of all their billions and billions of mind. Well, that's what the Stranger is for the Gigantons, or whatever we're calling them. So we get an origin for this character, the Stranger, which, okay, cool, nice, but what does that really have to do with anything? And the fact that it just has not been alluded to or foreshadowed in any way makes it not the most welcome appearance here. And Archie Goodwin makes an effort to sort of square this by saying, well, you know, it wasn't a total wasted effort here on the part of our heroes, the FF, because this fight caused the Overmind to expend so much of his energy that that's how the Stranger found him. So he's kind of trying to smooth it over, but it's kind of too little too late by then. So that ending wasn't the best in the world.
At least they set it up a little bit in the origin.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean,
it ties back to the origins.
Yeah. The Stranger, now I think of him as James Coburn. I don't know if you guys know who that is. Okay. He guest hosted The Muppet Show once and was a character actor for many years. My father was recognized as him at an airport once. But you know what would work better? Had the handsome Stranger shown up.
Oh, geez.
And saved the day.
Wow. Get an early Buff Bagwell appearance. What are we doing? What aren't we doing?
Where's Judy in that scenario?
Oh shit!
Judy is Agatha Harkness.
Jesus,
raising your boy.
You know, I also thought there was God. That was a delayed sell on my part. I also thought that there was an opportunity here that they could have tied some of the wonkier characterizations in this story, like Ben's being a huge dick, Reed is sort of all over the place, and you can't really read what his true intentions are, and Johnny's being like an emo little twerp. You know, tie that back to the Overmind. I almost called him the Mind Flayer.
No spoilers, please. No spoilers, please.
Yeah, no problem. Just make that part of his scheme, or just that's a byproduct of his influence, you know, that, and maybe it's suggested, but they never really give any kind of confirmation, but I think that would have helped, again, smooth over some of those wrinkles. Maybe that's my headcanon. I don't know.
I did appreciate the return appearance of the Yancey Street Gang.
Oh, yeah. Got them in
here. The stink bomb letter.
Yep. Good times.
All right. Anything else on this Fantastic Four story before we move forward? Hearing nothing, why don't we jump over and talk a little bit about the first appearance of one of Marvel's preeminent super teams, that of course being the Defenders, the foursome of Doctor Strange, Namor the Submariner, the Incredible Hulk, and the Silver Surfer. And their first appearance comes over in the pages of a magazine called Marvel Feature, which I'm not really sure what the concept of this one was. I can't remember. Tim or Todd, I'm sure you can clue us in on that one, but here we get a two-part story that sees Doctor Strange form the team and then later bring the team back together to go to fucking Rutland, Vermont. And if I never see Rutland, Vermont in the pages of a comic again, I will be very pleased. And yet I know we are going to get an ass full of it in the coming episodes, I'm sure. I really liked this first issue. I fucking hated this second issue. I am so over this, you know, look at how cutesy we are bullshit from the writers and these little in jokes and ha ha gags and stuff. Again, it's what I imagine most people listening to HTF feel like, and now I understand your pain, so I'm sorry. I guess in retrospect. This is awful. This is just fucking terrible. But the first issue was really good, and I even liked Don Heck on art, surprisingly. I thought had a little bit of a raw quality to it that kind of served the story.
It's Ross Andrews, sir. On the first one.
I thought it was Don Heck. Was it not?
No.
Don Heck does the second issue.
Does the second issue. Wow.
No, wait. Don Heck does the backup story of...
That's what it was. Yeah.
Doctor I knew Strange. I had Ross
somewhere. Expo. Yeah. Which, that wasn't good. So Ross Andrews was good in the first issue. My mistake. But yeah. So mixed bag here. I liked the first one. Hated the second one. Tim, what are your thoughts here?
Your reaction assures that there will be subsequent appearances of... Rutland, Vermont.
We're going to get more of the fucking Halloween parade.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the only thing about Rutland, Vermont that ever comes up is their great Halloween parade. Just crossroads of the universe here, Rutland, Vermont, that is just the most important locale in all of Marvel Comics. Marvel Feature. This is one of, I think, like three pretty similar anthology titles that debut in the 70s. You got Marvel Feature, you got Marvel Spotlight, what else? Marvel Premiere, and they don't really have much of a mission statement.
Amazing
other
Adventures.
Than, we've got Amazing Adventures. I think that started already. And we will be visiting these other books probably just in the next year. So look forward to 1972 for more confusing, interchangeable anthology series. They just sort of seem like tryout books for new concepts to see how they take off, I guess. Beyond that, nothing really notable or special about them in terms of having an identity onto themselves. But we've got Ross Andrew. Welcome aboard. I did enjoy his art here, possibly more than what we will be seeing when he does some Spider-Man work throughout the 70s. So again, another stay tuned, but very clean, but at the same time fits the story, this very supernatural vibe that they're kind of going for here. Weirdly enough, we do not see the Silver Surfer as part of this developing team. He makes an appearance, just kind of a quick one-off, as Doctor Strange tries to summon him, but then knocks himself out doing his usual thing of throwing himself against the barrier around the Earth that keeps him trapped here. So it's kind of like acting as if he's not going to be part of this crew. So that was something I guess I wasn't really prepared for. But yeah, I mean, there's not much to speak of in terms of the plot and the conflict itself in that first issue. We meet this guy, Yondroth, who is one of Doctor Strange's old foes. He has this basically literal doomsday plot device that says when he dies, this thing will go off and blow up the world. Of course, it spins on the tremendous coincidence and coup of planning on Yondroth's part that Doctor Strange will recruit Namor and the Hulk or some equivalent super strong bruisers to set this thing off. So that was a little bit what are we doing? But I kind of like this team, you know, it just inherently these guys, based on their characters, based on their personalities, have better interplay, no matter what the plot is going to be, than a bunch of geeks like the Avengers, who we have been covering as well. So already I'm just more interested and more engaged by this kind of setup, by this cast, than I am slogging through like those Avengers issues. And I'm not sure I had well-formed opinions about the Defenders and what early Defenders comics would be like, but so far I'm kind of digging it. I'm kind of along for this one. Second issue, you know, what can you say? It's here because we get another great Rutland, Vermont appearance. I sort of enjoyed the little mystical battle between Strange and Dormammu at the end, but beyond that, you know, you get to see Bruce Banner popping Quaaludes the whole story to not transform into the Hulk. It's got its moments, but yeah, I mean, we're just trying to get to the point of Avengers in their own series, which we will very soon.
Defenders, I mean, I think you meant to say.
Defenders.
Yes, it is coming very soon. Todd, your thoughts here on Marvel Feature 1 to 2.
This is very confusing for me, for I do not see Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, Daredevil, Iron Fist, nor Sigourney Weaver anywhere.
No.
But the interesting clash between these very well-drawn, well-developed personalities who've been part of the Marvel Universe for 10 years is an interesting chemistry. And again, issue one, very good. Issue two, very, very bad. Roy Thomas and his friend from Vermont, it's just super annoying, distracting to the point that I can't finish it, or like I can't endorse this comic. Although, I've always enjoyed the costume contests or the parade aspect, you know, where they throw in other characters, and they threw in Valkyrie here, which was an interesting choice too. But the issue one with the Doomsday Device machine was kind of cool, and recently referenced on Marvel.com, did a nice little animated short based on Defenders number one, because I think they're celebrating some kind of random on this day, which doesn't make any sense because according to Marvel U, this comic came out December 10th of that year. So what have you. I think that's a misprint or something because we read both of these issues in 1971.
I think Tim said something to the effect of because these were quarterly, they were street dated 3 months after their actual release date. Is that right?
Yeah, so the cover dates are pushed even further out apparently because it started as a quarterly shipping book. And I mean, normally I just go by cover date in putting together these reading lists, but because that issue two, I mean, it was apparently released in October. It's a Halloween themed issue and it's not like a March or April cover date, which it just felt weird trying to, you know, talk about that next month in 72 when it would have been so far removed from the rest of the year. So I stuck it in here.
That's one aspect I've never really understood, the whole like drastic shift in cover dates that comics companies used to employ. Like, I understand you want the comic to feel fresh when somebody sees it, but I don't know. I feel like the quality of the comic, the cover art will be more selling than a date in the upper corner. I don't know. Just my take on it.
Do they still do that? I mean, I still buy comics, but I've never...
Do they still even cover date them? I don't know.
Yeah.
I know that when I had a Marvel Mail subscription back in high school, which would have been 2004, 2005, they were still cover date comics at that point. Because I have many issues of Ultimate Spider-Man, and I don't know if they just cover dated their subscription copies or what was going on there, but I had cover dates on mine.
My understanding is it's just something that's always been, back in the day, it was geared towards the newsstand market to tell newsvendors, literally, here's how long you display this periodical.
Right.
Because there's going to be another one coming out, and you don't want to have old issues that are cluttering your bin piled up. You know, just want to refresh that on a regular basis, and this is a rough idea of how frequently to do that.
And the returnability of these comics from the newsstands, you know, they send them back and they get their sales figures from. Before I leave, I want to comment on the cover for Defenders 1. That was Neil Adams who did the art for that. Very smart of them to use a Neil Adams cover, and it is very strong. We may be talking about this cover later for Marvel Feature Number 1. Many of the covers of late 1971 seem to be dominated by borders and blocks that reduce the amount of cover art, maybe trying to give more prominence to the logos and the titles or the themes of the issue that they're putting in there. And I'm not a fan of that. Give me your full page of art, Marvel.
With you there.
I would agree with that as well. Russell, you haven't weighed in on these two issues yet. Do you have a defense of number two?
Well, first, issue one.
Yeah.
I thought that was real good.
It was.
That really got my attention. It drew me in a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting, because it was a Roy Thomas written book, and so far I haven't really found anything of his that I just really loved. But this was a pretty solid start, as everybody's kind of pointed out, that we don't really have a I don't think there is a Doctor Strange solo book running around right now, is there?
Nope.
No, I think they reference to that.
He's not there, so giving him a book like this that also pairs him, you know, or teams him up with Hulk and with Submariner, and at least in the first issue with Silver Surfer, that was fun. Like, I was having a really good time with that story. Thought it was pretty straightforward, good way to introduce a team, and I was looking very much forward to the next issue of it. Then I read the next issue of it, and I was like, oh, there's my old friend Roy Thomas. There's the guy that I know. The convoluted scripting, the just over-explaining every little thing. It was like he really had to have been high while he was doing this issue. I mean, I think the whole Quaaludes thing was actually Roy Thomas telling us what was happening in his office or in his bedroom or wherever it was he came up with these ideas. This was not good. I am totally with you guys. If I never have to hear any one word about Vermont ever again, it will be too soon. Why is that a thing? It still doesn't make sense, and it's really dumb here. The whole Dormammu thing on the surface is not really that bad of an idea. It's kind of a way to get around the deal that Dormammu made about never coming to Earth again. But then it would be, oh, well, what if I possess the body of Stephen Strange? On the surface, that's not a bad idea. Some of this is, you know, could have been okay, but Roy Thomas's script ruins everything and makes this almost unreadable. Like, I had to just start skimming through it because it was just it was word vomit. That's what Roy Thomas does on the page, is he just has a decent idea spread out and then he just pukes all over it.
I'll be honest, I rolled my eyes and started skimming as soon as I saw Rutland, Vermont. I was like, oh god.
Yeah.
And then, like, the first page is talking about Roy and Jeannie Thomas and that other
fight. Yes, I'm like, this, the coolest people in the room.
I tried to get through that. I almost did, and I was just like, I can't do this. It was just too much. And I just kind of like skimmed my way through the rest of it. It's like, I can get the gist of it from the artwork, even though there's so much dialogue on the page that it's practically covering all of it.
After reading this Rutland, Vermont stuff, I am now going to retroactively blame Roy Thomas and his bullshit for the existence of Grant Morrison. Thanks a lot, Roy. But anyway,
are you suggesting that 1971 readers would not have been thrilled to party with Roy Thomas and Jeannie Thomas and their great friend Tom Fagan at the Rutland Halloween parade?
The fuck is Tom Fagan?
He showed up multiple times.
My God, he's the organizer of the Rutland Halloween parade, baby.
If this issue is any indication, Tim, maybe he was the fun, quaalude-loaded guy to party with. I don't know.
Well, they could at least write him that way and make the comic more interesting, you know?
No. He tried writing a character that way, and it sucked. So Roy Thomas is not going to help his case by being high while continuing to write comics. He needs to put the shit down, put down the pen, and walk away. He's not good at this. I mean, I understand Stan can't write everything, but, I mean, you got to hire better, man, because this is not working.
And very soon, Stan's going to write nothing, but we will cross that bridge when we get there. Moving on, unless you guys have more to say about Marvel.
No.
Nope. Pass.
No more to add. I am going to throw you guys a bit of a curveball.
Oh, I have a little thing, too. I'm sorry. I did forget.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so there's this backup story about Doctor Strange reclaiming the mantle.
Yep.
And he's passing as a man named Steve Sanders, and yet he does not have a blonde afro. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, too far ahead of his time.
Also, Roy Thomas would subsequently get a divorce from Jeannie Thomas, who maybe was tired of him writing her into his stupid stories about the Rutland, Vermont parade. And then he married somebody named Danielle Thomas. So, you know, never write your then wife into a comic, because then you're going to have to be reminded of it for years and years.
Or, even better, you could write one of your friends' wives into a comic. You know, if you're a very good writer for DC in the 2000s, but that's neither here nor there.
Well done.
But in any event, I'm going to throw you guys a bit of a curveball in an effort to balance the episode in terms of issues covered before and after the break. And we're actually going to hit Captain America 143 here.
Oh, no.
Here we go.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Tim, help me out here, because I've already forgotten. What is Sam's girlfriend's name?
Okay, it's funny you should ask, because the whole issue, I'm sitting there going, does this lady even have a name? Have they bothered to, like, are they trying to make a statement here by not giving her a name? And then, finally, about two-thirds of the way through the issue, we learn that her name is Layla.
Okay, Layla.
Yes.
Look, I understand this is a comic written in a certain era, and Marvel at the time, by publishing such political viewpoints as espoused by Layla, were probably being very progressive, and it is on the surface a fine and noble thing that Marvel was doing. Layla as a comic book character that you actually have to try and read and empathize with, however, grates on the nerve a bit. And
a bit.
She has made minor appearances in prior Cap issues that we read in our last episode. And here she becomes a big fucking focus as she is trying to convince Sam of the virtues of her militant ways as it relates to race relations. Meanwhile, you know, Sam and Cap are trying to figure out why everybody can't just get along and how to quell this racial uprising that is happening on the streets of New York. And all the while, it is being the flames of division and hatred are being fostered by this dude under a mask. And wouldn't you know it, shock of shocks, the dude under the mask turns out to be the Red Skull. I was shocked. I know you guys were shocked. Captain America 143. 1970s Marvel has lots of examples of really progressive and ahead of its time political commentary that, while being of its time, manages to still be relevant somewhat and at least decently written. I don't know that Captain America 143 falls into that category. This is, of all the politically focused stories we've read, easily, to me, the worst. Like, not even close. By far the worst. Somebody defend this. Todd, try to defend this. Or don't. Your choice.
Why do you have to be such an Uncle Tom, Nick?
Ooh.
Well, I don't know that term applies to me, because I am a white man.
Oh, wait. But I have an Uncle Tom, and he is white.
I am
white.
A honky, as I am reminded many times in this issue.
This issue, we are all... No, this is indefensible. Gary Friedrich is not has not shown me anything. Some kind of average issues of the Hulk, and then this, which is appallingly bad. Yes, it's great that Marvel is bringing light to social issues, reflecting the time. You know, some discontent with the Richard Nixon era America, rise of the Black Panthers, and such. But is Captain America really the book to do it in? Well, I guess so, because you have Sam Wilson, the Falcon, the social worker who is there to give Layla her welfare check, as she reminds him later when she visits him in his office. I'm here for my welfare check. And she's saying that in a mocking way, which is pretty bad. But there's lots of pretty bad. Almost every panel has something cringeworthy in its dialogue. It's so bad. I think this is the second consecutive episode where we've had just a head-slappingly ridiculous comic to talk about. Last episode, we talked about that strange Tom Wolfe, Uncle Tom Wolfe Hulk comic, and now we have Captain America 143, the most, I don't want to say off color, but the strangest socially relevant comic I recall reading.
Russell? Oh God. the attempts to be socially relevant here just fall flat on their face. There's as Todd said, this is indefensible. You can't say anything really good here. I mean, I give John Romita credit for having like a really good turn on this issue. Like, he draws everything really well. It's artistically it's solid, but man, what were they thinking? This feels out of touch even for for 1970. It's like they were trying to characterize a movement that they did not understand. And, I guess props to you for trying to be inclusive, but that's as far as it goes, because it winds up getting it so wrong and being so wrongheaded that it comes off as making the movement itself into a caricature. It's so freaking bad. There is just the language used in this. And not just that, but this is one of the most misogynistic issues that we've seen yet. Like Cap himself is, but then Sam Wilson straight up like creates one of the worst Me Too moments in the comics we've read so far by just getting all up on Layla and be like, oh, I'll just put the moves on you and that'll make everything okay. And it's like, dear God, this is happening, isn't it? He's just going to start touching her. This is really uncomfortable. This is a sexual assault that we're watching right here, and it's too much, man. I can't believe that this issue continues on the way it does. Not only that, but the whole Red Skull return is one of the stupidest things that they've done. I mean, here's a dude, presumably Red Skull was German, yes?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Something like that.
Speaks with a thick German accent. So whenever he's talking to these folks, am I to understand that the Red Skull underneath that mask is attempting to talk as if he is an American black man?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God. I didn't think of that.
The Red Skull as to Malcolm X.
Yeah, and that's, I'm supposed to buy that. And also by that these people would be dumb enough to be led by whose face they've never
black
seen.
Black Klansman.
Basically wearing a hood, yeah.
Yeah, it's like it. This is, it's like inverse Clayton Bigsby, and it's so wrong. it's so, so bad. And then when he rips off the mask at the end, it's like, it was Red Skull the whole time. I'm like, of course it was. Sure it was. Great. Is this over yet? And I mean, the only real poignancy that we get in the issue is at the end when Cap and Sam are kind of having a bit of a discussion, or a misunderstanding over how things are actually going. And that's maybe the only part of the issue that I felt like it got even like somewhat right. But everything else is so, so bad that I don't want to encourage anybody to read this. I'm just going to say, hey, Red Skull is alive. Does it matter how? No, because they didn't even bother to tell you that in this story. They had to spend way, way more time writing black people saying honky. That's what Gary Friedrich wanted to spend his time doing. So talk about pissing away all the potential in the world. But, you know, that seems to be par for the course so far in part 3 of 71.
Well, from one honky to another, Tim, your thoughts on Captain America 143?
Should we even be talking about this?
that's an excellent question.
I do know this much. This story should not have been written by a white writer. I don't know very much.
That's a good question. Who was the first black writer for one of the big two?
One of the first. I don't know that he was the first, but you got then Jim Owsley, now
that's
Chris
who I was
Priest.
Thinking, Chris Priest.
So was he the first? I kind of think he might have been.
Yeah. I used to think the Black Panther writer Don McGregor was black, and he is not.
I know.
It's kind of surprising.
Matt Baker apparently was the first artist, and he was in the Golden Age.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Here's one.
Yeah, it's Chris Priest.
Faintest of praise here. Not praise. Defense, I don't know what to call it. I don't think that Gary Friedrich is as willfully ignorant as like the All Lives Matter idiots, you know? I think that he thinks he's trying to make a good point. Yeah. And he the road to hell are paved with good intentions is what it comes down to. And he is making these grand gestures towards relevancy and real world social injustices that he wants to say something about, but he's doing it in a way that it's like he's really into respectability politics, and it's very gross the way that he writes. Particularly the group is called the People's Militia in this story. They are easily duped by this hooded figurehead who, as Russell pointed out, is presumably the Red Skull trying to disguise his voice in a way that's probably extremely uncomfortable. And then they are attacking their own community with no clear motive. And it's just trivializing everything that he's trying to call attention to, Friedrich. The dialect, the overall portrayal of these protesters, it's very insulting. It's implausible. You could maybe pull this off with kind of a slower burn to get here, but I still don't think so. Having Captain America at the center of this, you know, a white kind of Aryan paragon, basically, fighting a bunch of black protesters is really bad optics that maybe nobody thought of at the time. There's so much wrong here that it thinks it's getting right, and wow, what a misfire. I talk about being unprepared for something like that second Defender story. I was very unprepared for this. The misogyny as well that Russell touched upon with Sam Wilson and Layla, he's like pawing at her, and it's really just oogs you out. They also imply, after they kind of establish this whatever it's going to be relationship between them, that there was a transactional element to this.
Yes.
He only went to this protest because she, you know, fucked him.
Yes.
I don't know if that makes it better or worse. I guess it's better than the all-out a sexual assault that it looks like.
That's like every country concert I've ever attended.
Oh, come now. Come now.
I did then.
I got nothing else really. I didn't know this comic exists. It's a well put together, well paced comic that is awful. It's awful in its messaging, and I don't think it was good at the time. It certainly has not gotten better with time. Although I am sort of, I don't want to say glad that we read it. I'm glad that we discovered it, because I never knew such a thing existed. And you have hidden gems, and sometimes you have hidden turds. And I think we endeavor to cover both on this podcast. It's important, yeah.
Absolutely. You got to have a little bit of good with the bad, I suppose. Or in this case, a little bit of bad with the also bad. So, in any event, any other thoughts on Captain America 143?
Thing you guys don't understand about Captain America 143 is that it's absolute shit.
I think we do understand that.
Oh, sorry.
This, by the way, Gary Friedrich's second issue on the series. We read 142, which he took over from Stan Lee, finishing off that Grey Gargoyle story. Mm-hmm. And that was fine enough, right? Didn't have a lot of qualms with that one. But
it wasn't good, but I mean, like, it was, you know.
They recapped it for the first three pages of this.
Yeah. Right, you got that. It wasn't upsetting. You know, in the second issue of the series, he's going on this thing, telling the story that I guess he was just really itching to tell about how Black Power rallies are just as dangerous as White Power rallies. That was the point he seemed to be making here.
I suppose.
And I was just
there's
awestruck.
Good people on both sides, Tim.
It I really know. Is that kind yeah. of shit.
It felt like that too. I agree with you.
Yeah, but.
I don't know if
have you had a chance to weigh in on this issue yet? I can't remember.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah. This is terrible. Okay. It sucks. All right. It's putrid.
I just want to make sure everybody had an opportunity to take a shot.
Why'd they do it? What were they thinking?
No one knows.
No one can say.
I can't think of any better place for us to pause for a moment and take a break. And
take
when we
a
come
shower.
Back. When we come back, I promise we will cover things that are at the very least better than Captain America 143. Stick with us through the break. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of our episode covering the third part of 1971. Not that we're getting convoluted, much like Rambo First Blood Part 2 here or anything. But in any event, before we continue on our journey through 1971 in the Marvel Universe, we must take you on a journey through all the offerings we have this week over at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop, starting with the Pop feed. Tim, take it away.
Yeah, so you had the Sarcastic Four. Hey, that's us. Continuing our look at 1971 with the second of our three-part look at the year on Marvel Age. So, if you didn't listen to part two of this program, you should do that so that you can get at least two-thirds of the year. You also have episode 31 of the Songs with Friends podcast with Steve and Kelly. They talked some Gin Blossoms and some DMX. I believe this was part of the tribute to the year 1994 that is currently ongoing here on Place to Be Nation. Now, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, of which Nick Duke is one half, they are celebrating Spider-Man Month. They look back at the 2002 Sam Raimi-directed Spider-Man, the one that started it all. Nick, anything to add on that note?
It's a wonderful film. Greg has been underappreciative of it, I think, for a long time. He's been underappreciative of, in particular, the Willem Dafoe performance as Norman Osborn and the Green Goblin. And in this episode, you will get to hear him admit why all his Spider-Man takes are bad and wrong, and how he should reconsider everything he's ever said related to the character.
Wow, sounds like one to look forward to. DC for you continues its celebration of Superman. The look back at the pilot episode for the classic Lois
air
and
quotes.
Clark.
Well, it's not in quotes.
Air quotes.
Not
for me to say. Lois and Clark, the new adventures of Superman.
For
and
5 minutes
they
per
pay,
hour.
They pay tribute to the late Eddie Jones, who turned in a great portrayal of Pa Kent from that show. Interesting series, that, Lois and Clark. So, one that perhaps I will revisit someday.
It certainly ages better than Dean Cain.
Okay, that is a fair statement. Yeah, the less said about Dean Cain today, the better. Pop goes to the movies, went to the movies, when Andy and Miranda discussed Toy Story 4, I'll get it right eventually, and Men in Black International. Good stuff. Glenn and Alana were back with a spectacular review of Stranger Things Season 3. I do recommend you check out that episode. Very good stuff there. Great insights by Glenn and Alana. They've been here before. It's not their first barbecue. So check out that episode, talking Season 3 of the great favorite Stranger Things. Finally, The Great Debate, Episode 6. That was Andy with, again, Nick Duke, Jordan Duncan, and Scott Criscolo. Nick, do you remember what you guys talked about on that episode?
Oh, a great many topics. Fascinating topics you can hear myself and the other three ruminate on. Topics to include, for example, whether one prefers the bottom or top half of an English muffin.
Yes. Now, I have a point or a contention. There was no debating. It was just people saying their favorite stuff. Nobody tried to just say, Criscolo, you're just reciting something you read off of Wikipedia. Jordan, you're just saying those things because you like those things. It was not like trying to convince each other to change their minds. Mm-hmm. It was just, what do you like the best? What do you like the best? Very good listen. I'd like to see some more baiting or debating.
Well, sir, I would direct you to, you can direct your complaints to @ JR's BBQ on Twitter and take it up with him as to the format of that show.
Will do.
I would like to see more personal attacks and hurt feelings. But that's going to wrap it up for the Place Me Nation pop feed.
Absolutely.
I believe Todd is going to tell you about some songs that aren't necessarily with friends that we can have a debate about. So what's happening?
Hi, I'm Todd Weber. I own Place to Be Nation pop podcast feed. And here on placetobenation.com, we've got the greatest song of the 80s tournament. Every day, there are 6 matchups. You click on the song you like the best. The one that wins advances to the next round. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. Every day, feelings are getting hurt. Opinions are being proven wrong. Myopia is being exposed. But be sure to weigh in. Be part of the conversation. Join the fun.
And each and every day you can see a new list of 12 songs included in the tournament, none of which will be country songs, because that genre might as well not exist as it relates to our Northeastern overlords. Yeah, not in the tournament, I'm sure. But in any event,
Elvira.
In the tournament.
Oh, baby, show me that myopia.
In any event, over at the PTBN Wrestling feed, Ben Zani drops two episodes of Row 1, Seat 1 this week, welcoming in guests Dominic Greeny and Tony Deppen. On episode 130 of Main Event, Scott, Nate, and Steve are joined by Sheriff Pete Schirmacher to talk New Japan, G1 Climax, AEW, Impact, Evolve, and much more. Chris and Devon, or Devon, if you're nasty, are back to bring you a same-night review of Extreme Rules 2019. In the latest episode of the PTBN podcast, JT and Scott welcome Tim Slomka to the mothership as they talk the WWF MSG House Show from October 1989. And don't miss the pilot episode of a new ECW-focused podcast entitled PTBN Extreme Three-Way Dance, where hosts JT Rosero, Jennifer Smith, and John D'Amato review the concept of the show and what is to come.
Yeah, and of course, on placetobenation.com, you can check out PTBN's tribute to 1994, as was alluded to earlier. That's been off and running for a little while. There's a brand new piece on Woodstock 1994, as well as a piece where JT looks back at Bob Backlund challenging Bret Hart for the WWF title on Superstars. Mm-hmm. Also, Excellent Network Adventure Team is back with a look at Black Saturday from 1984. And don't forget to check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
GWWE?
Huh? What?
Well, with all that being said, let's get back to the topic at hand, that, of course, being 1971 in the Marvel Universe. When we left off before the break, I promised you something that was, at the very least, better than Captain America 143, and I am here to deliver that to you now, as we will discuss The Amazing Spider-Man 100 through 102. This, of course, sees us reach the landmark 100th issue of this title, kicking off a little storyline known as the Six Arms Saga. Peter has decided in his infinite wisdom that he's finally ready to put being Spider-Man aside and focus on his future with Gwen Stacy. That he wants that to be the new focus of his life. But he knows that if he still has his spider powers, he will always have that temptation to come back and don the red and blue tights once more. So he takes a formula he has been developing off page for some time that he refers to that has been ready, but he was just too scared to try it. He downs it. He falls asleep. He has an awesome fever dream that sees him confronting all of his worst villains, who are all telling him all the things he believes to be true about himself, all his giving in to all of his worst self-deprecations and lack of self-confidence and guilt at times. And yet at the end of the issue, he overcomes all that. He wakes up. And when he wakes up, he finds that he has sprouted four extra arms in his sleep. Naturally, he sets off to find help for this particular condition, and who would know better about this than a good old Kurt Connors, a.k.a. the Lizard. So he takes off to a Kurt Connors secret laboratory he has at a house on the Cape or on the Bay or something of that effect. Little does he know that house has been broken into and has been made home by one Michael Morbius, who is making his debut here in these pages. We get a little flashback story revealing the origins of Michael Morbius, and in the big final issue, we get Morbius, the Lizard, and Spider-Man and all kind of having this extreme three-way dance, as it were. And eventually it all wraps up in a nice, neat little bow. Morbius falls into the ocean at the time, presumably to never be heard from again. We all know that's bullshit. Spider-Man gets his arms removed and goes back to his original status quo. The Lizard goes back to being Kurt Connors, and everything and everyone lives happily ever after. I really liked issue 100. The fever dream, as I said earlier, was fucking amazing. I love little flashbacks like that, little, you know, smorgasbords of the character's history up to this point. Gil Kane's art was really good. The Morbius stuff, however, did not play for me in the least. So all in all, this three-parter has a bit of a disjointed feel. Great issue 100, pretty lackluster 101 and 102. Tim, your thoughts?
Think I'm going to be in the minority here. I thought ASM 100 was just okay. Not bad. Fine. Gets the job done. But I wanted something a little more. I wanted something a little bit different from this anniversary issue of Amazing Spider-Man. Some of my own biases perhaps coming to light. I think dreams are stupid. I think dream stories are just, they don't typically lend the kinds of wisdom and insight that I think their authors think they do. There is some fun dream logic here by Stan going on as he writes this, but I was just, there's no real stakes, of course. You know, it's all a dream. We know that, whatever. But I think more egregiously, the problem here is that it has the knock-on effect of making you sort of doubt the cliffhanger, which is Peter waking up to discover he has sprouted 4 additional limbs. So they have to add this little clumsy narrative caption saying, you know, hey, true believers, this is really what's happening. He's awake. And I don't know, it just took me out of it a little bit. Even knowing, yes, this is really happening, we're not still in the dream, I didn't think those two tastes really went together very well. And all in all, issue 100, it just felt like the comics equivalent of a clip show that, like, a television program would do. And just something that Stan Lee is doing because he thinks he's supposed to do it and not necessarily because he believes that much in the story. So it was fine, competently done, but left me a bit cold. Issue 101, yikes. So Roy Thomas is scripting this, and I wondered what he was on when he was doing so, because it's very manic, this script. I mean, the story itself is okay from a plot standpoint. That may be more down to Stan Lee than Roy Thomas. But I know that this is a very harrowing situation for Peter Parker, but Roy's voice for the character just feels off and wrong. And, man, it's just a script that goes to 11. I want to tell him to calm the fuck down with the quips nonstop and the references, like, in virtually every word balloon or thought bubble. Just pump the brakes, dude. Morbius, his first appearance. We don't get a whole lot of information in terms of his background here, but if nothing else, I will appreciate just how truly bizarre this character looks in his first appearance. Props to Gil Kane, I guess, but man, those eyes, just so freaky. I don't know what to do with it. That is not a character design that I think a lot of people are necessarily most familiar with for Morbius here. And then we get the wrap-up, of course, in 102. It's fine. I wrote down that Morbius wants to drain the lizard, so there you go. You're welcome.
I love your enthusiasm for that joke. That almost makes the joke better.
Someone had to say it.
There you go, yep.
A lot of coincidences here that sort of start to pile up and bother you, right? Where you've got Morbius with this enzyme in his blood that just so happens to have the ability to dissolve surplus limbs, I guess. So that's great, but you also need Spider-Man to actually meet Morbius. So two things that need to happen here. We also need Kirk Connors to show up at the right time. So three things. we need to test this theory that Morbius has blood that dissolves extra limbs by, you know, having that occur with the lizard whom he bites. So we need him to bite the lizard who shows up, who is Kurt Connors, who coincidentally, again, turns into the lizard. So we've got just coincidence on top of coincidence here that, wow, the coincidence gods were really smiling upon us this day to give us this story. I know I sound very negative about this three-parter, but I mean, I thought it was okay. It didn't, there's nothing that really shook me to my core like that Captain America 143 nonsense. And it reads fine, well-paced. You know, there's a certain level of craftsmanship here, but not the best work we've seen from a series that I think we have come to expect a little bit better from.
Absolutely. Russell, your thoughts here on ASM?
I'm going to be a good bit higher on this one than I think either of you two guys. And that's because for some reason I'm fascinated by Morbius as a character, just as a concept. And I've never really been able to explain that because honestly he's not one of Spider-Man's better villains in my reading of it. But I have a, I guess it was my affinity for those episodes of the 1990s Spider-Man animated series whenever they did the origin of Morbius. It also tied it into the Six-Arm saga. So it was really cool to visit this in its original comic book form to see how all of this, you know, really comes together.
May I interrupt with a question?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Do you feel, as I do, that Morbius drained the plasma of his shipmates using little plungers in the palms of his hands?
If only. If only. I really like the idea of Morbius giving him a handy, or like, you know,
there we
his
go.
His version of it anyway. Now, this take on Morbius is, of course, different from that animated version. We see that he's a Nobel Prize winning scientist who was trying to cure himself of a very nondescript affliction that he already had, and winds up, using vampire bats because, you know, of course, and makes himself worse. Turns himself into a, what we know as a living vampire. So sunlight doesn't really kill him so much as it subdues the raging beast within. So yet again, another Jekyll and Hyde villain from Stan Lee and company.
Comics cool, pal.
Yeah, it is what it is as far as like his origins. Though I do like the kind of horror aspect of his origins, the whole part through the bowels of the ship where he's like, you know, wantonly murdering people and feeding on them, but then feels really bad about it later. So all that was fine, and I do like the body horror element of the Six-Arm saga. I was actually I was always a big fan of that aspect of the Spider-Man mythos. Though I am glad that it doesn't last any longer than it does. I feel like that's an element of the character that should really only go so far. And as you'll probably remember, Tim, in the animated series, instead of them developing a cure that takes the six arms away, it mutates him into the Man Spider.
I do remember.
And it goes on for quite a while longer and turns into a Kraven the Hunter story, which actually turns out to be pretty good.
And they're using the neogenic recombinator, right?
Yes,
that
yes.
Was the big MacGuffin.
That was the neogenic nightmare story arc that flowed through that entire season. I actually do think that this plot really does work for me because I like seeing the lizard, or Kurt Connors anyway, being brought into it as the only other scientist that Peter would trust with this. Newfound problem that he has. I've got six arms. Who do I know that's ever dealt with any kind of like radical transformation like this? Oh, Dr. Kurt Connors. He seems like a guy that, you know, might have some resources that would be useful to me. Morbius being there is a little bit of a, I guess it's a Deus Ex Machina, so that we have, yeah, it's a stretch, so that we can have a villain in this story prior to Kurt Connor showing up. So, you know, fair enough, and at least his story is a good bit different from what we've seen from other Spider-Man villains. So I'm on board. The dialogue from Roy Thomas, you're right, it's not very good. Stan Lee was way better at this, but this is for sure a Stan Lee plot. This is something that that he definitely would have come up with. I really love the background drama of Gwen Stacy trying to find out if, you know, something is really up with Peter. Like, she's just calling Aunt May to check on her in one scene to see, you know, why is Peter suddenly distancing himself from me after we just talked about, you know, like living together and like being super serious. And as it, you know, as it turns out, we know what's going on with Peter. But when she calls Aunt May and finds out that, oh, she doesn't know anything about what's going on with Peter, he's not left town at all, according to her, Gwen is suffering kind of an emotional breakdown. And it's, you know, it's...
She's also pregnant.
Yes, she has had Norman Osborn's children.
Did she have those in Europe?
Yeah, she had those in Europe.
Okay, she's postpartum depressed.
Yeah, that's holy what's going shit. On. But her,
it kind of works though. It kind of does.
The Todd groan.
It's terrible, but it works.
And I will say this for issue 102, it's another one of those extra long issues that we talked about. But this was maybe the only one of the extra long issues that we read that didn't actually feel that way to me. It felt like it moved at a good clip. I enjoyed the conflict between Morbius and the Lizard. I did also chuckle to myself about him draining the Lizard. I thought that was a good joke, Tim. And this is all fine to me. I felt like it wraps up in a pretty decent way. And of course, we all know that Morbius will be back. He will be a recurring villain throughout Spider-Man's history, and I believe that he will have some encounters with another vampire character in Marvel, that being Blade, at some point down the line. So this is all fine for me. I love Gil Kane's art. I find the stuff, especially some of the stuff that he's drawing when it's just Morbius, whenever he's talking or like going through Morbius's memories, some of that really, really worked for me, especially in issue 102. And one of these issues also gave me a new meme to play with in a panel where Morbius is looking straight up saying, "I thirst." So that's going to come back at some point or another. Dug these issues, had a great time reading them, despite some of Roy Thomas's unfortunate word balloon choices.
Awesome. Todd.
Yes.
Your thoughts here.
Yes. Morbius or more BS? Because this was... Not this, well, 100 was great in its own way. You know, you get kind of the mission statement of a 100th issue is to revisit but still press forward, kind of like Fantastic Four 100, where you had like a look into all the other concepts that come out in Fantastic Four. Here you have this typical self-doubting Peter Parker, but like you said, Nick, this developed off-screen or off-page formula to rid him of his spider powers, to have a cure. And yet we get an origin recap. We get all of his various rogues in individual battle sequences. And it's pretty good. It's a good way for Stan to go out on, I think. And yet he wakes up from the dream with, oh no, 4 more limbs. What am I going to do? Now, the thing is, people generally have 2 arms and 2 legs, but spiders have 8 legs. Do they, though? Well, Robert Parker has five limbs. But you didn't hear that from me.
What are we doing?
What are we doing? 101 and 102, however, have the distinction of being the first very mediocre to bad issues of The Amazing Spider-Man I have read at Marvel Age to this point. And that's very strong words, I know. But
I don't really disagree.
This Roy Thomas script, and I suppose it's a stand plot. I guess it is, because, you know, you go through the thing, you get through the thing in a couple issues, and the status quo is restored. It just, I don't care about Morbius. I'm not given enough necessarily to care about here. The Gil Kane art is getting more Gil Kane-y, if that, do you understand what I'm saying? You see a lot of upturned noses. Do you hear me? Peter Parker wants his four limbs removed.
Morbius has a very pig nose.
He doesn't have, well, even as a human, he barely has a nose at all. Is right. This the condition that he's trying to get cured from? Or is it just a matter of being drawn by Gil Kane, who draws faces like that?
I don't know. It could be a byproduct of his condition.
So, you know, it's all eventually wrapped up. I do like Morbius cover on 101, but we'll talk about covers later in this episode. However, 101 and 102, Roy is trying way too hard. He's trying way, way too hard to hit the Peter character, and it doesn't quite fit. But magically, everything is restored at the end. I did like some of the Gil Kane art on the Wizard. That was nice to see John Romita doing the inks for Kane, because I think that was a really good team, and we're not getting that here. So 100, yes. 101, 102, nah.
All right. Any other comments on 100 through 102 before we move on?
Morbius sucks.
I see what you did there. So moving on to our final bit of comics we're going to cover in 1971, that would be Thor, 191 through 194. This is the final set of issues written by Stan Lee, and Jerry Conway comes on to actually finish out this story. And this story sees us pick up with Loki has seized the Odin Ring and the powers of Odin, and therefore is deemed Lord of Asgard. He is the king. He is sitting there on the throne giving commands to all his subjects. Odin refuses to challenge him because he has the ring, as Odin says. Odin's like, you know what? I'm a stickler for the rules. We're going to go by the rules, and he's your new king. I'm going off to sleep. And so Odin heads off to the Odin sleep, and what follows, of course, is Thor battling in earnest to assert Loki, to knock him off of the throne, reclaim the Odin ring, and give it back to his father. Over the course of these issues, we see Loki create Durok the Destroyer. Is that what they called him?
I don't Demolisher.
Know. Demolisher. I knew it had an alliterative name, but I couldn't remember what. Not the greatest Thor villain in the world. Loki also seeks to screw with Thor by trying to marry the Lady Sif, by torturing Baldur in the Warriors 3. Meanwhile, you've got a really good little subplot in the background with Baldur trying to do the right thing, and Carnilla just becoming increasingly frustrated by his nobility and his inability to just focus on their love as opposed to doing the right thing at all times, which is a nice character touch for Baldur. All in all, it's Thor, so I'm probably a little kinder to it than I should be. I still enjoyed this, even if it wasn't up to the quality of some of the Jack Kirby-drawn Thor stuff that we've read in years past. Todd, your thoughts here on this four-part Thor story?
This is good comics, my friend. This is an epic. Just the right amount of pacing. Great scripting by Lee and then Conway, who maybe, I'm not going to say he improves on the Lee stuff, but it's almost not a drop-off. You know, you noticed when almost everybody, say maybe Archie Goodwin, came in and replaced Stan. What's that? You okay there?
Yeah, I was just coughing. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay, good. Conway keeps it going and maintains the momentum of this story. There's a lot going on, first with the ascension of Loki to the throne, and he's got the ring. the ring is the thing. It's like a battle wool ring or something. that
if he would simply take the ring and swallow it, he would get all of Odin's powers. And I learned that from Abyss swallowing Hulk Hogan's Hall of Fame ring in TNA.
Ah, yes, Abyss, fine worker, Abyss. We have Thor with no lips, which gave John Buscema a little less work to do. Thor had briefly no mouth, and Sif was very unhappy about this. But there was lots going on with Odin kind of making it up to Thor, entering the Odin sleep, Thor getting all these waves of Asgardians after him, Baldur trying to help him, but being unable to because to something about this pledge with Carnilla. I need somebody to explain it to me because I'm merely a pawn in the game of life. But Baldur made a deal with Carnilla that I will love you as long as, or you will love me, or you will not kill Thor as long as I don't attack somebody. Is that correct?
Something like that.
Something like that? Is that the gist of it? Because every time we're getting hints of Baldur. Baldur and Carnilla is an interesting concept, but I don't think it's clearly, at least it's not clearly enough defined for me. The Buscema art is great here, depending on the inker. Sometimes the inks are thick and give you nice details, but sometimes they're very simplistic and you get like the John Byrne in his later days things where there's just no backgrounds whatsoever and you just have the figures. But I thought it was a great story. Four issues of good father issue stuff for Thor. Eventually, Silver Surfer gets called in and helps take care of business on Earth, Midgard, after Baldur wins him over. The villain or the MacGuffin of a villain is kind of a mort, but eventually it's turned out that Odin knew that this would happen because not everybody can handle Odin's ring. Am I right? Anyway, good story, honestly. It really was. I enjoyed it more than anything else consistently this time around. What say you, Tim or Russell?
Well, I do agree that this was paced really well. All the fight scenes are drawn extremely well. Like I really liked John and Sal Buscema's art on this because they actually did share duties on at least one issue. I believe it's on 193. Silver Surfer stuff I also enjoyed, and I liked the especially the setup drama of all this. It felt like okay, we're really getting into something now. You know, Loki does seem to have Odin by the short and curlies, and has everybody kind of bending to his will. So all of that was working for me, and I do like the vast majority of how this flows. It's fun comics, but there is something that I just can't ignore. Loki is the Dr. Evil of Marvel right now, because throughout this four-part story in which one of these issues is double-sized, Loki continuously puts Thor against like these like MacGuffin style like creations, these weird villains that he has to take on, who are supposed to eliminate him because Thor has no help coming. But at one point, Loki seems fed up with the whole thing and is going to finally use the Odin ring because he could have destroyed Thor all this time. So it's like, we put him in easily escapable traps and assume it all went to plan. What? That's Loki throughout this whole exercise is, I'm going to put him in an easily escapable trap and assume it all went to plan. Excuse me while I go take a dump on my solid gold toilet. It's the part that just bugged me and I couldn't get it out of my head. As I was reading all these issues, and you know, great artwork helps to, you know, distract from all of that. It certainly helps that the fight scenes are fun, that Loki does some really weird shit to to both Thor and Baldur. Like at one point, you know, we talked about how he took Thor's mouth away, or no, Odin took Thor's mouth away, but Loki turns Baldur into some kind of weird green, like goblin-esque like caricature, and then eventually melts that face back into Baldur's face. So this is a man, if you were to actually like make a film version of this, it would be pretty horrific at times. I thought Silver Surfer was actually used to pretty great effect, so that was fun. These weird, like, gigantic troll things. Yeah, that was just another odd thing for Thor to wind up.
Storm giants. Storm giants, not to be confused with frost giants, I guess.
Supposedly no, and then we have a moment where Thor actually turns back into Donald Blake in issue 194, and I thought that was going to be a little bit more of a thing, but it's over very quickly. So all that to say, this was fun comics. I did enjoy reading this, but there's some shit in there that is a little too hard for me to overlook, and it's that I kept waiting for Loki to explain his dastardly plan, only to put his pinky up to the corner of his mouth as if he's, you know, the cleverest being in the entire universe. Did like the twist at the end, though, with Odin basically saying, you know, I've had this under control the whole time. I knew he was going to, you know, eventually burn himself out because no one can handle Odin's ring but Odin. That was good. That was certainly a better Deus Ex Machina ending than what Fantastic Four gave us. So all that, I'm on board with that. I like that. That was fine stuff. Other than that, Jerry Conn's script, I actually thought that he did a really great job. He kept things punchy and reasonably short is how I would look at it. He wasn't like, he's not overly verbose, so we're starting to see a shift in the approach that a lot of these writers are going to start taking, I think. And this is young Jerry Conway, so he's going to approach it in a way that is more forward-thinking than a lot of his elders at this point. So good stuff here. Good debut for Jerry Conway. Looking forward to reading more stuff from him. And hopefully some of it does come on Thor. And I'm sure that he's going to have a good long tenure on one of my other favorite titles in the not-too-distant future.
There you go. Tim, your thoughts here.
I will say that I think Thor, more so than something like Fantastic Four, has suffered the most for Jack Kirby's departure. That is to take nothing away from John Buscema, no disrespect at all to him, because he does turn in very good work on this series, but this was the type of story that you felt like you were really hurting for some Kirby art. Setup itself feels a little bit like, haven't we seen this? Haven't we done this before? Loki usurping the throne, he's got the ring. But I did appreciate the fact that this story confirms that the ring itself does seem to impart actual powers. It's not just a Asgardian ceremonial, like strict adherence to their culture kind of thing that people have to do what Loki says and he's now all powerful because he has this ring. It's like, no, he really does have these vast powers and can do pretty much whatever he wants. So, okay, cool. That was an unanswered question I had from the last go-round where we read something along these lines. Durok the Demolisher, kind of a budget executioner, right? He sort of has a similar look, or maybe a budget destroyer, too.
Yeah.
The same concept of he's just this sort of
mindless
thing. Yeah, killing machine. But it does, you know, propel some pretty decent action scenes. I especially appreciated the Silver Surfer's role in this story, which we really see that come into play in 193. But before I get ahead of myself, I will mention in 192, the main thrust of that story was a little bit more of the same, kind of nothing doing, but you have this little side quest from Balder where he says, oh, while I have agreed to not raise my sword in defense of Thor, I will not take up arms to aid him. I can recruit this ally of great power. So there's this mystery man that he's looking for who he's going to recruit and hook Thor up with. I didn't know who that was going to be, and I really thought it delivered with that reveal of the Silver Surfer. Like, that was where, you know, I figuratively put the book down and said, business is about to pick up here. And it did not disappoint. There was some really cool, like, cross-cutting between scenes in the oversized issue 193 with the Silver Surfer kind of contending with Jurok the Demolisher, and then Thor's quest to get back to Asgard, where he's just coming up against obstacle after obstacle. Really great stuff there. I found myself getting very invested in the closing pages of that story in particular in 193. I also audibly gasped when the Silver Surfer's board was shattered into a million pieces. Did not see that one coming, although it is put together, like, put back together immediately. But just one of those things that you're just like, okay, I didn't think I was going to see this in this comic. That's, like, a pretty big, impactful scene. And then the wrap-up, of course, we get, as we've talked about, Odin comes back into the picture. Odin looks like a little bit of a chode here, I will say. He says he knew this would all come to pass, that thought it would be essentially a good opportunity for a lesson in humility, also a good opportunity for him to catch a nap, so good times, Odin. But yeah, I mean, the resolution is kind of, I won't call it anticlimactic. I mean, you've got to end the story somehow or another. So it works for what it is. But I don't know. I felt like it, it could have been more, just more epic, just kept up that sense of scale and just the grandiose, nature that this story had been up to that issue. Jerry Conway taking over for Stan Lee, I would agree with what was said before. If anything, Jerry Conway's script is even more extra than Stan Lee's with the just the Shakespearean dialect. He's really laying it on thick, but unlike Roy Thomas, in a way that is very appreciated here. Balder and Carnilla, I don't totally get their relationship, but they are so toxic. It's amazing, and I kind of love it. I mean, it's terrible, but it's fun to read. So kind of looking forward to more from those two. But yeah, all in all, pretty solid four-parter here.
Absolutely agreed. Any further comments on Thor 191 to 194 before we wrap up? Hearing none, since this is the end of our discussion of 1971, we will wrap up as we do every time we reach the end of a year with our year-end awards. So why don't we start with Writer of the Year this time out? And I will say, for me personally, probably the last time we'll be able to give this award to him, because he's kind of stepping away, but the work on Amazing Spider-Man, the work on Thor, the work on Fantastic Four, I think it's still Stan Lee, because did we read anything that was good and not written by Stan Lee?
The Goodwin scripted Doctor Doom Fantastic Four issue.
Yeah, and that was literally it, right?
And Conway.
Yeah. My point being, the vast majority of the good things we read were written by Stan Lee. So Stan Lee is my writer.
Doc Samson issue.
Oh, God. Go ahead, Todd. Go ahead and give your writer of the year to whoever wrote the Doc Samson shit.
Yeah, that is not the winner of the Writer of the Year, because clearly Writer of the Year is Mr. Roy Thomas, who once again did superior work all throughout, trying hard to be. I'm just kidding. It is Stan Lee for the very last time, unfortunately. Stan, we'll miss you. Thank you for the work of establishing this. And I feel like this is kind of like a very clear end of the Silver Age moment. I know technically the Bronze Age, people, you know, there are people who categorize everything, but it just feels like we're on to something very new with this new wave of writers, the Archie Goodwins, Jerry Conways, and people like Denny O'Neill, and we'll see other people coming up, and we'll talk about them too. But the Stan has left the building. Actually, he hasn't left the building, but he has left the scripting. So salute to you, Stan, the writer of 1971.
Absolutely. Tim, you're writer of the year.
Yeah, I kind of feel like we keep saying it will be the last time we give it to Stan, but here we are again giving it to Stan. I can't disagree with anything that our compatriots have said. Well, really just you and Todd so far, I suppose. But we will get some more run-ins by Stan Lee later, but for all intents and purposes, that steady hand that he's had in guiding stuff like Fantastic Four and Amazing Spider-Man, Captain America, which wrapped up in our second installment of the year, certainly here Thor as well, handing that off to Jerry Conway. He had gotten to that point where, like, it was such a well-oiled machine, the way that he kind of ran the publishing side of Marvel Comics, even losing his, you know, longtime collaborator and Jack Kirby. I kind of felt like he didn't miss a beat. Some of those books visually certainly were not as captivating, but if anything, maybe were even stronger in terms of the writing. So yeah, Stan Lee is surprisingly enough to me will be dearly missed. We will have to see if the likes of Conway and Goodwin and Gag Roy Thomas step up to the plate here.
Indeed we shall. Russell, clean sweep for Stan, I'm assuming?
It is indeed. Easiest decision on this year, Stan Lee. Clean sweep all the way across for all the reasons that you guys have said. And even though there's some promise to a few of the writers that are coming in, Archie Goodwin, Jerry Conway, not enough from them as of yet to really unseat the resident king of Marvel Comics. So yeah, Stan for maybe the last time gets my writer of the year.
Absolutely. Moving on to artist of the year, I'm gonna let Todd go first here because I have a pick and I'm gonna withhold it until the end.
And I guarantee you, none of you have the same pick as I do.
Okay, go.
In part two, we had
Gray Morrow.
Yes, it is. Did you say Gray Morrow?
Yes.
Gray Morrow, fine artist, my friend.
From Savage Tales, the first appearance of the Man-Thing.
Which was not on this list, and neither did we talk about it. Well, it was on this list, but we didn't talk about it. Gray Morrow, as opposed to Gray Marrow, which is the color of blood marrow when it has the blood sucked out of it. We have 1971 featuring the Incredible Hulk, artist Herb Trimpe, but inker John Severin, and John Severin made the most unique art that I appreciated the most of this year. So even though he did not have the volume of someone say John Buscema or Sal Buscema or Gil Kane, I'm going to give it to John Severin because it was unlike anything else I saw, even though I appreciated, say, the Neil Adams art that we had in the Kree-Skrull War. It's nice to see Neil do stuff besides X-Men. I'm still giving it to Severin for this time.
Awesome. Russell, your artist of the year.
There's a strong case to be made for John Buscema, just for the sheer amount of work he had to do and for how decent of a Kirby impression he does on Fantastic Four. And I actually toyed around with maybe John Romita because I actually thought that he drew those issues of Captain America really well, despite the fact that they're garbage issues. Now, I can't give it to anybody else, though, than my number one, I think, again, who are number one that was, I think I've been telegraphing it for every episode, and that's Gil Kane for his work on Amazing Spider-Man. Continues to be dynamic as hell. Just so much fun to look at how he draws these characters. I love what he's bringing to the table. His character designs on Morbius were great. I love how he drew the Lizard, and the way he renders Peter Parker in and out of spider costume is absolutely fantastic. So yeah, Gil Kane kind of walking away with it for me for this year.
Tim?
I almost have the same answer as Todd, even though he didn't think anyone would. Because I was thinking of that Hulk issue as well, but because of the fact that I was kind of struggling a little bit to remember who it was that did that, and it was only the one issue, I think on the basis of volume, I can't give it the nod, but I will give the nod, like Russell did, to Gil Kane. Consistent and very consistently good on Amazing Spider-Man, even if the stories he was having to illustrate perhaps were not the most inspiring in the world, as we talked about earlier. Doesn't skimp on the details, which I really appreciate. And one thing I did not remark upon in that little three-parter from issue 100 to 102 was the art. I slept on that a bit, and there was a reason for it, because I wanted to talk about Gil Kane here and acknowledge the great body horror that we saw in that story, the Six-Arm Saga, and excellent body English as well by Gil Kane. So props to Mr. Kane here and this year. Don't know if I will have an opportunity to say that again. So, deservingly so, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Gil Kane as well. I know Todd took a little shot about upturned noses and stuff like that earlier, but I don't know. Everything that he really did on Spider-Man in this year worked for me. I liked the way he drew Norman Osborn. I liked the depiction of Harry during the drug crisis. I liked the stuff we saw in this episode. So, yeah, Gil Kane on Spider-Man pretty much all the way around. There you are. So, moving over, why don't we do our cover of the year? And this one, I know, Russell, you were researching it. Why don't you lead us off here?
This was tough because there really weren't like a ton of really great covers. And I wound up narrowing this down to four. And I can only give it to one. So I'm going to go with, even though I was real close to giving it to Amazing Spider-Man 100 because I really love that cover. But I think I got to go with kind of my dark horse candidate here, if you will, and a surprise pick, Captain America 133. This was from a couple of episodes, or maybe one episode back. When did we talk about 133?
That would have been during our first episode of the year, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, all the way back to the first episode, because I love the design of this cover. It's very movie poster-esque. It has the origin of MODOK on the front of it. You got MODOK seemingly like right here above Captain America in an action pose. You've got Sam Wilson behind him holding up Falcon, and then the tease of that story element going on. And you've got the unfortunately named Bulldozer character hanging out above them, like destroying a building. It's a pretty epic looking cover that brings to mind the idea of a big summer blockbuster. Even though that issue was, as I recall, not very good. In fact, not good at all. But I thought that it had a fantastic cover, one that that just really sticks with me, and yeah, I had to wind up giving it that, although there were a couple of other covers that were real close on this one, including a Fantastic Four and the cover to Marvel feature number one. I was real close on all of that, but yeah, I think I just really like the very action-heavy movie poster-like dynamics of Captain America 133.
Todd, your cover of the year.
Marvel feature number one, drawn by Mr. Neil Adams, a man with whom I have pressed flesh.
Wow.
All right.
Flesh pressing you've ever experienced.
He told me all about it, too. That was a great handshake on my part, sir. I'm going to say Amazing Spider-Man 100, drawn by John Romita, also outstanding, kind of memorable for the inverted design, you know, where you had the black background and the light inks on the faces in Spidey. But we've seen a lot of covers like that, honestly. But
yeah, it's a guilt.
Classic John Romita. But I'm going to give it, because I had not experienced it, it's a full page of art, unlike many of the covers of 1971, to Neil Adams' first Defenders story with the Hulk, Doctor Strange, and Namor. Boom.
Outstanding. Tim, your cover of the year.
Ditto. But before I say that, you know what? Oh, God, I can't believe I'm going to say this. Captain America 143 is, like, actually not a bad cover for far and away the worst issue we've, like, ever read. So I won't even give it dishonorable mentions, but just something that struck me. It's a cover that you see and you go, well, this might be a good story. And then the disparity between cover art and contents of the issue are just so, it's a chasm. I will not give that issue any accolades. I'm going to go with Marvel feature number one as well. The Defenders, come on, it's Neil Adams. It's this great kind of money shot of three characters who typically are not associated with one another, but are very well defined, and that just grabs your interest. You want to know, hey, what's the reason for these guys hooking up? What's this comic going to be like? So Defenders gets it. Hey, good logo, too.
Hey, Tim Capel.
Yes, sir.
Look at the Todd top Weber. Of the page on Captain America 143.
The cover itself.
Look at the top.
All right.
What do you see?
There. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. All right. You said the top of the cover. Okay. We've got Captain America and the Falcon.
Look at the Falcon, sir.
Hey, he doesn't look like that.
He doesn't look like that.
Red and white costume, which he is not wearing. So we have Captain America. We have the Falcon twice on this cover. They're figures that sort of bookend the logo here. And then we have the actual foreground design here. But the Falcon is in different costumes, one of which more iconically associated with them. He has not appeared in yet. I don't know. What's going on there?
It's very strange.
Anyway, yeah, put that comic down. Never open it again.
Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. You introduce a new costume for the character, in which this character is very centrally featured, and yet there's no mention of it. Also, why is a Falcon Red Wing red?
I don't know.
It's a genetic defect of some sort. I don't know, man.
Why did Red Wing rescue them from a sophisticated death trap? That issue's so horrible. Anyway.
Yeah, my cover of the year, you guys have mentioned it, a couple people have mentioned it. I'm going to go with Amazing Spider-Man 100. John Romita, as Todd said earlier, I love it. I love these kinds of covers. I'm a sucker for these kinds of covers. They bust out for anniversaries that tend to feature glimpses at the entire cast. This one kind of inverts the color, black background with kind of the outlines of these faces. And it kind of highlights, again, the theme of this issue that is enclosed in the pages, which is that Parker guilt, that sense of guilt, and all these different influences on Peter throughout this 100-issue journey. So, yeah, I'm going Amazing Spider-Man 100. Let's move over to our villain of the year. This one ought to be interesting. And I think I am going to go... Oh, man, this one's tough. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to pass the buck for now and go over to Tim Cable.
Struggling a little bit myself. Gary Friedrich is our villain of the year. feels like not a great year for villains, right? So our options are a little bit limited here, but I think I will say the Green Goblin, Norman Osborn. Great re-debut for the character. Good, like, last page reveal and cliffhanger. And I don't really want to say too much more on that right now, other than welcome back. Good stuff.
Russell?
Stan Lee for hiring Gary Friedrich. I don't know. I'm agreeing with Tim. This is not a good year for villains at all. It's a tough slog to actually pick anybody.
I just thought of a different option, but no, I'm going to stick with... what brought me to the dance.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to wind up going with Green Goblin as well, just because it was a fun, like Tim said, it was a fun re-debut for the character, and I always like Norman Osborn whenever he's written, when he's written well, and I thought this was a good turn for the character, and some big foreshadowing for stuff to come up later with him. So I'm comfortable with that because there really are just no other standout villains this year for me.
Todd?
Well, I think Tim was about to say Ben Grimm.
Yeah.
Right?
No. No, but he's an option for sure.
But I thought about that too. But no, it's Norman Osborn. The sense of dread you get kind of throughout that issue, I think it's 96. And ultimately that reveal, just it's great. Norman / Green Goblin as the villain of the year works for me. Plus he pops up in a dream sequence in 100.
He does indeed. I think I'm going to go with you guys as well and go with Norman, although upon reflection, I think it's really close because there is something, as much as I love the more modern and nuanced version of Loki that we see in current Thor comics, something about the shit-eatingly smug Loki whenever he gets one over on anyone is pretty damn good in these pages of 191 through 194. There's a certain charm about it, but you know, as Todd just mentioned, the kind of sense of dread and foreboding you get knowing where Norman Osborn is about to go and then seeing how it all plays out in those three issues of Amazing Spider-Man, I'll go Norman Osborn as well.
Tim, you know, curiously, what were you going to say?
I was going to say the person I thought of and I thought Nick might go with, didn't see a lot of in this year, but honorable mention, Sam Bullitt.
Oh, yeah.
Spider-Man, the crooked politician. Yeah. Probably could make a better case for him in 70 than 71.
Yeah, I would agree. Hero of the year is a bit easier. I think it's Spider-Man by a slam dunk because the other stuff that we read, by and large, either we read very small bits of it or it wasn't very good. So Spider-Man's kind of the only thing that we read a good chunk of that kind of had some consistency about it. Thor was good as well, but I don't know. For me, the Spider-Man stuff that was here was good enough to carry Spider-Man over the hump once more. So I'm going Peter Parker as my hero of the year. Todd?
Yeah, without question. Thor kind of got emasculated by his own dad there, if you think about it.
That's like Thor every 3 months.
Yeah, that's true.
The 60s and 70s.
Every issue. The Submariner did a lot this year. Kind of his proto-Defenders and then the actual Defenders. But yeah, I think it's Spider-Man. He had some great issues. You got to see just him battling back, gaining arms, losing arms, what have you.
Tim?
Yeah, it's a little bit process of elimination. It's not Rick Jones. It's not Captain Marvel. It's certainly not the Hulk. None of the FFs. Probably not Captain America's finest year.
Valkyrie?
So, Valkyrie, yeah. Kind of between Thor and Spidey, I would give the nod to Spidey as well.
Awesome. Russell?
Took the words right out of my mouth, Todd. I was actually real close on Submariner as well. I thought that he started off really good in 71. His solo comic especially, like I really enjoyed those issues. But he seemed to kind of, you know, slowly drift off by the end of the year to the point where he's playing like second or third fiddle once the Defender stuff actually comes around. So it's clean sweep. It's Spider-Man by a pretty easy walking win, I think.
All right. Moving on to our story of the year. I will lead off again here, and I think this one, pretty easy choice for me. We read some good stuff, but the only thing that I think approached true greatness in 1971 was that three-part Amazing Spider-Man 96 through 98, kind of focusing on the topic of, you know, drug use, dealing with the return of Norman Osborn as the Green Goblin, and how in the meantime you've got Harry going through what he's going through. Kind of just peak Spider-Man stuff here with Peter, a good balance between Peter's own personal problems and his costumed identity as Spider-Man causing him all kinds of grief as well. Nice balance here. Great stuff in those three issues of Amazing Spider-Man. So I'm going with that. Tim, your choice.
Yep. ASM 96 through 98. I will also acknowledge that there is a higher degree of difficulty in pulling off a story like this. It's mm-hmm. something that, based on its reputation going in, you feel like could be kind of mawkish, could be kind of arch, and just too after school specially. And it is anything but. So for that, I think it's even more of an achievement than just being a really good story. So I'm with you there.
Todd?
Come on. Nothing else but this and maybe the Thor, but we've kind of exposed the problems we had with Thor. And I would like to loop in 99 and 100 too, because they were each going in different directions, but they were both excellent as well. So yeah, Amazing Spider-Man 96 through 98. You get Mary Jane Watson starring in Hair. What more could you want?
Absolutely. Russell, making it a clean sweep, I assume?
Yep. But like Todd, I'm going to do a little different. I'm going to go 96 through 99 because I felt like that was the real story arc there. 99 is really just like a slice of life kind of story, but it's so like nice and like refreshing after the heaviness of 96 through 98 that I feel like that's the really good way to end that story. So I'm glad that we read that all in a single part when we did 71 part 2. So yeah, Amazing Spider-Man 96 through 99 for all of those really great Green Goblin issues, and then the just fun slice of life issue that makes you feel good about the future for Peter Parker in issue 99.
And it lasts, it virtually lasts all no amount of time.
One issue, but you know what? They gave it to me for at least a minute.
All right. So with all that being said, I think that wraps up our discussion on 1971 in the Marvel Universe. When next we convene, we will be talking about 1972, part one of 1972. And Tim, before I give the listeners this list, is this final or are we going to be making some?
This is final. Yeah, this is
final. Nice. So So buckle up, folks. We got a bit of a hefty one next time out. We're going to be covering a smorgasbord of different concepts, little one and two parters, Mike, for the most part, across the Marvel Universe. So here's what we'll be covering next time out.
21
issues. We will be wrapping up Kree Skrull War with 95 through 97. We will be taking a look at the debut of Marvel Team Up with issues 1 and 2. We'll be looking at at the first appearance of the Werewolf by Night in Marvel Spotlight 2 to 3. We'll be looking at the first appearance of Marvel's Dracula in Tomb of Dracula 1 to 2. We'll be checking in on Daredevil, which we haven't done in some time. In the pages of Daredevil 86 through 87. We will be looking at The Power of Warlock in Marvel Premiere 1 to 2. Galactus will return in Fantastic Four 120 to 123. We will get Amazing Adventures 11 through 13. And what is this, Tim? Lo, a Beast is Born?
Yeah, it's, you will see. You will find out.
And, of course, Shanna the She-Devil makes her grand debut in the Marvel Universe in Shanna the She-Devil number one. I, for one, am really looking forward to that.
I put that on there in the hopes that it's terrible.
Yes, that is the hope. But just a variety of different concepts. It looks like 72 is going to see Marvel taking the approach of, like, we've hit gold so many times, so let's throw some shit at the wall and see what sticks. And as we know, most of this is not going to stick, but it feels like a company at the peak of its power saying, we can do anything, and needing to find out that they kind of can't. So,
and it's a lot of issues, but at the same time, we're not spending a whole lot of our reading experience on, like, any one series. There's just, like you said, it's one and it's like two issue stories, just across the spectrum here of all these different new series debuting characters and concepts that we will see how some of this fares. There's we won't be wanting for variety, I don't think, in this next installment.
Now, of course, there is an actual Kree Skrull War in our Kree Skrull War issues. Yes,
we hope.
Likely not enough to redeem this god awful storyline, but we shall see.
Legendary Kree Skrull War.
Again, as I said earlier, with your classic on Lois and Clark, let's put some air quotes around that, please. Legendary.
Yeah, but at least this one earns it.
To each their own. But in any event, that as I said, that it concludes our discussion of 1971 in the Marvel Universe. Before we sign off, we'll close the show as we do every time with giving everyone an opportunity to plug their shit. I, of course, can be heard over on the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. We have a certain distinction that you may have heard once or twice before. I'll let you figure out what that is, but we are in the midst of Spider Month. As you heard earlier during the live read, we've got some good Spider-Man content out there for you right now, including a review of Spider-Man Far From Home, a countdown of our top five Spidey villains, including Greg's list that is so bad it must be heard to be believed, and most recently a review of Sam Raimi's 2002 Spider-Man. And by the time this is out, you're probably only a couple of days away from us dropping our final episode of the month, which is going to be a long book hunt on the classic Kraven's Last Hunt, which neither of us have ever read before. So new perspective on that, looking forward to it. Tim, plug your shit.
Okay. On this very feed, Place to Be Nation Pop, my frequent collaborator Jennifer Smith and I had two podcasts, one of which is called Talkin' Pop. Look for that. We will have a guest in our most recent latest episode, which you probably are not hearing yet, but will be released in the days to come. I also joined Jenny for her show, Freak Out Drive-In, which is a horror movie watch-along type podcast where I will go ahead and give y'all a scoop. We watched, in celebration of Crawl this month at the movies, Lake Placid from 1999.
That's a great one.
I thought you said Kroll. Kroll.
Kroll. Kroll the Conqueror. No. Kroll, the great killer alligator hurricane flood movie, which I've yet to see, but I'm very much looking forward to. We also have a show on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed called not Talking Pop, but Talking WCW. And that's me and Jenny, joined by Greg, Nick, your longtime hetero life mate. So we'll have an episode.
Mostly hetero.
Well, yeah, that's debatable. Fair point. Yeah, and on social media, you can find me at Psyche68 on Twitter. Easy for me to say, CYKE68 on Twitter.
Awesome. Russell, plug your shit.
Well, most of you have already heard back during the live read what me and Todd have got going on. We are in the midst of Superman Month on DC4U. We actually just wrapped that up with our look at Lois and Clark's pilot episode, and it is indeed a classic. No air quotes required. We also did a short tribute to Eddie Jones, who recently passed away. Of course, he played Pa Kent on that show for all three, four of its seasons, I believe is how many it was on. But in addition to that, we're going to have a new episode this week looking at some of the big DC Comics and DC TV and movie news coming out of San Diego Comic-Con. So that's going to be a fun one to do. Hope you guys will be listening out for that one. Should be hitting your way on Thursday.
Awesome. Todd, any shit to plug that Russell didn't touch on?
No, I'm good.
Fantastic. Well, all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. We hope you will join us once more when we start our journey into 1972. And with all that being said, catch you next time. Enough said.